call to order the House Committee on Environment and Water, and although we are short on committee, we're going to charge ahead anyway with a public hearing on House Bill 2184. So let me open that. This is the bottle bill task force recommendations, a DEQ bill, and we had an initial public hearing last week and promised to follow up to hear from some of the folks who we did not hear from when we first spent a couple of hours with this bill. So let's start with, just going to go in the order there on the list, the sign-up sheet from last week. There may be an additional sign-up sheet there. If you didn't sign up last week and want to testify, we will try to get to you. We have a very full agenda, however, so we're going to go relatively quickly. But I'm going to call Paul Romain, Mike Dewey, and Andrea Salinas, if we could hear from the three of you.
Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Andrea Salinas. I'm the Legislative Director of the Oregon Environmental Council. OEC supports House Bill 2184 and endorses the Oregon Bottle Bill Task Force recommendations to double the deposit value from 5 cents to 10 cents, add all beverage containers with the exception of milk, milk substitutes, and a list of other covered containers, and set a benchmark goal for the redemption rate of containers at 80% by 2015. The proposed expansion of the bottle bill is an important element in Oregon's efforts to reduce its greenhouse gas emissions. By removing materials from the waste stream, Oregonians can reduce greenhouse gas emissions associated both with the energy used in the production of goods and with the decomposition of waste in landfills. The current bottle bill should be updated in order to realize the potential carbon savings from containers now in use. Many of these were not commercially available or regularly used by consumers when the bill was first established in 1970, and hence an insignificant portion of the overall waste stream. Increasing the value of deposit and expanding the variety of containers that would be covered would in effect increase the amount of containers being recycled. The subsequent GHG reductions would stem from energy savings resulting from the displacement of virgin resources by the use of post-consumer aluminum, glass, and plastic. New estimates from DEQ show that over a 20-year period, 2 million metric tons of carbon dioxide can be saved through this simple expansion. This is the equivalent of saving 250 million gallons of gas over the same period, or taking 25,000 cars off the road per year. Global warming is one of Governor Kulongoski's key legislative priorities, and the suite of climate bills now under consideration include broad measures to increase dramatically the development of energy efficiency and renewable energy. However, we need to continue to realize all emission reductions from other sectors, such as materials waste management, as identified by the initial 2004 Oregon Strategy for Greenhouse Gas Reductions, if we are to meet the statutory greenhouse gas reduction goals established by law in 2007. Thank you, and I'm happy to take any questions.
Thanks. Let's hear from our other two panelists. And
you're the bottle bill guy.
Yeah, you're going to have some screw ass.
Mr. Romain, go ahead.
Sorry, the play here. I'm Paul Romain. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romain. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I'm representing the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. I've been living the bottle bill for a long time here in the state of Oregon, had a lot to do with the legislation last session in putting this together, and just a couple of observations. One is House Bill 2184 is a great place for you to start in 2011. You should do absolutely nothing this session. And I say that seriously. What we did two years ago is totally revise the way the bottle bill normally works, or at least we hope we totally revise the way the bottle bill normally works. Bottle bills, and the reason it worked in Oregon to begin with, were based on existing systems that were in place for return of beverages and refill of beverages. There were exclusive territories in beer and soft drinks that allowed for the easy transition to a mandated system. There was everything you mandated pretty much was already in the system. Bottle bills traditionally work on exclusive territories. When you move to water, and we begged you last time to only move to water as an experiment, you were moving to a product that was not in a traditional exclusive territory system. So you had to figure out a way to get the bottle and the nickel back together. What we devised was a cooperative system where, in effect, there was a central bank, not the state. It was the distributors who set up the bank and basically put the system together and used the money that came into that bank to hopefully build recycling centers to take some pressure off the retail community, either by elimination of some return to retail or modification of return to retail. But all of that is an experiment right now. We tried for a long time to get this up and running, and now they finally are to the point where it is pretty close to being up and running, and you will have to see if it works. Because frankly, if it doesn't work, you can't just magically expand the bottle bill. By bringing in new containers back to retail, you are already stretching the system. If this works, if the 90 redemption centers planned by the Beverage Recycling Cooperative work, if modifications to that work, there's no limit to what you can bring back. If it doesn't work, there's no end to the grief that you're going to have if you keep trying to shove more stuff in the system. You've got to make the system work before you expand it beyond its capacity. Right now, most distributors in the state who are included in the bottle bill are part of this cooperative, but in far eastern Oregon, they're not. They've chosen not to belong to the cooperative. We have a challenge. Can that really work? Will they be forced into a co-op? How do we account for the bottles and cans that are out in that area? Is there a way we can do that? If you raise the deposit to 10 cents, you have a huge amount of cross-border traffic. Witness the state of Michigan, which has a huge fraud problem. Can we solve that problem? Does the addition of redemption centers, manned redemption centers, does that help solve the problem? Answer is probably yes, but we don't know. How is this thing going to work? So we would ask you to please do absolutely nothing. Take this wonderful bill, and a lot of effort went into it, and print it up again with the word with 2011 on it, and bring it back, and let's renew the discussion then. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Ridley. Mr. Dewey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Mike Dewey, Waste Management.
And let me remind our audience as well as our folks up at the dais to keep those cell phones off, which is what I'm doing with mine.
Thank you. Waste Management, just for background purposes, operates two solid waste landfills in Oregon, a hazardous waste landfill, transfer stations, and I think is the largest hauler, solid waste hauler in the state of Oregon. One of the things we're doing, just as an aside, and this gets me to my remarks, is that at the Arlington landfill, we do take some garbage, a substantial amount, by rail, and we are permitting that for electricity distribution. And we're developing a contract with Seattle Power and Light, which seems appropriate, through the grid. And we're doing the same thing in McMinnville. And one of the things that we want to do is, at some point in time, also is fuel our trucks with the methane. With regard to where you go with this bill, we would like to have a conversation, and we're, a bit player as to 10 cents, 15 cents, what is in, what is out. But if you do go to redemption centers, we would argue that one of the issues is going to be convenience. And because the 5 cents is not what it is today, and we collect the redeemable deposits, and lots of those today, as do haulers around the state of Oregon, quite frankly, most of what I have goes into the bin for recycling purposes. It doesn't go to the store. One of the things that Waste Management would like to do is we'd like to move our trucks in Oregon. We're doing this in Southern California and Seattle. and converting those from a diesel fleet to a compressed natural gas fleet. When you do that, the fueling station is fairly expensive. The conversion is expensive, but nonetheless, at the end of the day, and I have a chart, and I looked at it, and I thought it would be better to get you some additional explanation behind this. But with regard to that conversion, if you go to compressed natural gas with trucks that are going to be compliant in 2010, the NOx, which is greenhouse gas, the emissions are zero, and the PM, the particulates, are zero. Okay, so what would we like to do? Well, we have BETSI tax credits. There are other tax credits. We'd like to have the discussion of taking the nickel today and utilizing that to a program that is audited so we can make the conversion to do what's right to the environment. Now, I understand this nickel is very important to a lot of people. We're collecting it. If you go to redemption centers, I think we're going to see more in our bins. We don't want to have it go to landfills. That's very clear. But there are some public policies around this that might be appropriate. So this is perhaps an aside, but at least Waste Management wanted to put this on the table so as you move further, you can have some conversations about maybe, you know, working outside the box. So with that, Mr. Chair, that's all I have to say today, and I look forward to talking to you more about this.
Thank you. Open it up to questions, but first let me just follow up on your suggestion, Mike. I think it's an interesting one. Your challenge currently is that the law limits the number of redemptions that a person or company could bring to a retailer today. Certainly you're not going to be sitting at one of those reverse vending machines with, you know, thousands of containers. It simply wouldn't be practicable. Is that the primary sort of barrier to redeeming these?
Yeah, and we understand that it makes no sense to take a couple tons of what we collect in a day to a retail facility. It would go to a material recovery facility. There would be sampling and audits and so forth, so you could get to the right kind of appropriation. So you hit the nail on the head. It's sometimes we may be inefficient, but we're not going to the Safeway, if you will.
Right. Are there questions from members of the committee? Representative Benz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Romaine, your remark about the border crossing situation calls to mind my constituent who lives in Ontario, and he's talking about the economic downturn is causing people in Idaho to flood into Oregon late at night with truckloads of cans, and his fear is that if it raises to a dime, that flood will turn into a tsunami. So my question to you, are you hearing this from other folks? Is this what you were alluding to when you talked about the fraud issue? And if so, do you have a solution for it?
I was with you till the last thing. Mr. Chair, Representative Benz, yes, you hear that all the time on every border. 10 cent in Michigan has prompted a number of fraud cases, if you would. The last one was a recyclers that had actually gone in cahoots with some retailers in Michigan, and the amount that was in the paper was about $34 million worth of fraud. So the problem is it's a nickel here, a nickel there. It becomes real money after a while. So, yes, there is that problem. If I might, and if everybody's been groping for a solution, one potential is a UPC code that is unique to Oregon. You may or may not have interstate commerce clause problems with that. Pepsi ran an experiment where they did a unique UPC code, and what they found was in the Janssen Beach area, 40% of all containers were from Washington State. So, yes, it is a very real problem, even at a nickel. If I might say one thing about redemption, if you have more than 144 containers, you can take the containers to a distributor, whoever distributes that product, and they have to take them back. So there's no limit for what you can take to a distributor. The problem is you have to turn over the material to that distributor, and I think that may be one of the problems if you want to have your cake and eat it too. But so if you actually have large numbers of containers, you can go to the Coke or Pepsi or beer distributor and bring them back.
Right, but that would require sorting as well.
Mr. Chair, yes, it would. You could only take the Coke back to the Coke,
right.
The Pepsi back to the Pepsi,
right.
The Bud to the Bud, yes.
Do you want to comment on that, Mr. Dewey?
I think it's plain what the problem would be in that this is commingled, and these are large bins, so I think you understand that issue.
Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Romaine, what did you mean there? I didn't understand the part about the material, if you went back to distribute.
What happened, Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, when you bring a container back to get the nickel, you have to give up the container. So either to the machine or to the distributor or whatever, it's an exchange. We have the nickel deposit. You have the container. If you want the container back, you have to give us, the nickel back, you have to give us the container or the container equivalent in a commingled situation. If you do go to a cooperative situation where everything is commingled, then, again, you don't have to sort it out. You just need to give back the amount.
Mr. Dewey, you know what it's called when you in this whole process where you lose a nickel? It's the lost money. Do you know what that's called?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, I think it's called a lot of money.
I think you're right, and I am concerned about recovering that. In any little way that I can. Were you referencing your home when you said that you give up those bottles, or were you referencing waste management?
I was referencing my home and what I do personally with whatever bottles I have. It's not convenient for a nickel for me to go to the retail facility. I'll leave it in the bin. Allied picks it up. And we think we have an opportunity to solve a whole host of problems here, notwithstanding the 2011 date.
Would you be willing to give your address to the? All right, thank you.
One related to your original, I think, serious question to Mr.
Hard to say,
Romaine. As a member of the task force, one of the things we learned about was the value of the material itself, and in fact, while at least at the time, and these markets fluctuate, at least at the time. Plastic was not worth much on the recycling market, if anything, and glass was also, I believe, not particularly valuable. Aluminum was and has been quite valuable. When you're talking about millions of containers, you're talking about a significant revenue source for the processor, the recycler, who then sells those on the markets. And I think that's, you didn't say it quite directly, Mr. Romaine, but I think that was also part of the question.
But
Representative,
the serious part, Mr. Yep. Chair. Some of the problems would be finding the distributor, having a quantity that you'd want to take back, and then arranging, because they're not set up for that. They have to do it, but wouldn't that be difficult to arrange with the distributor?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gilliam, no, they're used to, all distributors take back things right now. They take back everything that's sold to an on-premise location, anything that the cooperative, Crink, when it was set up, and the beverage co-op basically just do off-premise sales.
Okay. I didn't realize. Yeah.
Questions from the Cyber Representative Smith.
To anybody, but maybe Paul, the you mentioned interstate commerce. If we required people who are bringing back over X number of bottles and cans to show their Oregon driver's license, would that violate interstate commerce?
Mr. Chair,
our
Representative
best guess,
Smith, if you just required them to show a driver's license, it depends what the sanction is, whether it's
down.
But if the container was, if you could prove the problem is you can't prove the container wasn't, you can't set a proof up to say the container has to have been purchased in Oregon.
Yeah.
Manufacturers, for convenience purposes, have, in effect, set up a container that has many states on it, and they sell it everywhere. There is absolutely no way to prove, unless you do some kind of separate UPC code, that container was actually purchased in the state of Oregon, unless you say you could only sell certain kinds of containers within the state of Oregon. And I say this because it's an unclear area. There have been many cases where you say, for example, price affirmation in alcohol sales. It used to be the rage that a state, like a monopoly state, would say, you have to sell to us at the lowest price that you're going to sell any place in the country. And the problem is the U.S. Supreme Court threw that out because, in effect, what you're doing is setting the price for another state out there because they couldn't sell it any lower than, say, the state of Oregon or whatever state it was. It's never been tried with this situation. It's unique. The industry has been trying like crazy to come up with a way to distinguish. Believe me, it's been in our best interest to try and figure out a way to stem cross-border traffic to the point where literally distributors have been advocates of a national bottle bill for years purely out of self-interest. But if you raise that deposit to a dime, you exacerbate the problem. State of Michigan has just done a few things with some markings on the cans, and we're waiting to see whether that works. It's not a separate UPC code, but there may be ways to mark cans. They haven't touched bottles yet. So we are working on solutions. We're trying.
Follow-up, Representative. Yeah, and actually, speaking to the chair and the committee, it might be something. I mean, I know that there is the disagreement about the dime, and I have my sort of dollar menu challenge, and when, if ever, is the time to raise it, and maybe it's only nationally, and there will be disagreement there that will, I imagine, persist. But one thing we might consider in terms of ameliorating some potential impacts as we go forward, or if we go forward, is having people show their driver's license. Now, my guess is if they showed a Washington license, and I guess it's Washington and Idaho are the only ones really worried about, that if they showed their Idaho driver's license, you wouldn't be allowed to say, okay, you're not allowed to turn your cans in. My guess is that would violate the Commerce Clause. But if although I'm not sure, it's worth checking, but the mere act of showing it and having it logged might be a deterrent. My guess is there are very few Oregonians who go to Washington, buy a large number of cans, and then bring them back to Oregon. Right? My guess is the Washingtonians who are fraudulently using our bottle bill are people who, or not fraud, you know, whatever, are getting, you know, are Washingtonians and are getting Washington. So we might have a license requirement to show over X number of things, license requirement, and the and maybe over X plus X number, X plus Y number, or even just X number. I can use another letter. That you log it, right? That you write it down. You know, if somebody brings in 1,000 cans, you say this person was Washington, and then at least that might provide a deterrent. And if at some point you wanted to do a suit, you could do a suit.
To whom would they show the license?
I don't know. That's, you know.
I want to move on, and we have other folks to testify. I think that's an interesting suggestion. It's an issue that the task force explored as well, and was found it challenging to come up with really effective recommendations related to fraud. Do you have a final question for you, Paul? And I was hoping that John Anderson would be here today. He's not.
He's in Maine.
He's in Maine.
Looking at the system.
Ah, very good. Well, your member, your clients are, many of them at least, members of the cooperative.
Yes.
My question is whether the cooperative, you know, backed by the distributors, will be prepared to share with the legislature numbers in total of sales and redemptions. When we consider issues related to cross-border traffic, when we consider the fact that we're going to have to figure out how you're potentially meeting a redemption rate that could be set in statute, when we have to decide whether or not we're going to go to 10 cents, it would be, I think that's information that we need to have as a state, that the public needs to have to evaluate the success of the bottle bill. So is it your understanding that the cooperative will be prepared to share with us total sales, total redeemed?
Mr. Chair, I can't speak for the cooperative because I'm not the attorney nor the lobbyist for the cooperative. I know when Container Recovery was here, we offered to share all that. The problem right now is you're going to have to give the cooperative a time to actually get real numbers from the state, because as the bottle bill can be seasonal, it can vary month to month, and so my guess is by maybe the end of this year, you'll have some real numbers that you can actually look at. But I don't I can't speak for the cooperative, but Container Recovery never had a problem.
And Ms. Kufori, maybe this is something that we can follow up about offline. Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I have John Charles, Holly Sears, and Betsy Earls. John is not in the room. Holly is. Betsy is not, although she may be around. Randy Tucker submitted written testimony. We have written testimony for the record from Metro. Let's have Lee Barrett and Peggy Lynch come on up as well. Go ahead, Holly.
Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Holly Sears, and I'm the Governmental Affairs Director for the Oregon Refuse and Recycling Association. ORA is a trade association that represents private solid waste management companies in Oregon. ORA has participated in bottle bill discussions for some time, mostly offering technical advice about different options that have been considered. While neutral on many aspects of the bottle bill, when the topic of redemption centers was discussed, ORA thought that this was an area where our members could possibly contribute. I'm here today to offer our assistance in trying to establish redemption centers throughout Oregon. We have members that operate transfer stations all across the state, from Astoria to Pendleton to Eugene, and several of them have informed me that they would be willing to be part of discussions about redemption centers and possibly participate in a redemption center pilot project. Our facilities are already built and designed to accommodate traffic flow, and people already come to us with their e-waste, scrap metal, wood, batteries, paint, as well as several other items. Our reason for being here today is really to offer our resources and our existing infrastructure and the possibility that we may contribute to this discussion in a positive way. So thank you for the opportunity to testify, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thanks.
I guess I win. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Peggy Lynch. I'm the Natural Resources Coordinator for the League of Women Voters of Oregon. The League of Women Voters is a grassroots, nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. And the League has long been in support of Oregon's bottle bill and was encouraged by the 2007 passage of Senate Bill 707 to expand Oregon's successful bottle and can return program. I'm not going to read the entire letter. The middle part of the letter are in italics that show the testimony that we provided to the task force as they did their work. In the center, I would note that we believe that industries that provide products should bear the cost of such recycling, with some responsibility placed on consumers to actively recycle those containers. We realize that with expansion, there is some concern related to the amount of recycling that local stores can absorb. However, we cannot afford to lose the convenience of having some recycling continue at these locations. We believe that these stores also benefit by having recycling on their premises, since many people take that opportunity to shop when recycling. So I'll get to the bottom line. We're asking the committee to consider the ideas that the task force brought before you. Increase the deposit. A nickel here, a dime there is real money. Increase the containers covered. Require that some recycling still occur at local stores, and increase the expected recycling rate to encourage all of us to be better stewards. To use a motto of a Beaverton shoe manufacturer who is now recycling their shoes, just do it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Lee. Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Lee Barrett. I live in Portland, Oregon. I am a member of the Association of Oregon Recyclers, but this afternoon I'm simply testifying on my own behalf. I want to make three points, if I can, about HB 2184. There's been a lot of debate initially about whether this was a conservation bill or was this a litter bill and so on and so forth. The fact remains that after some 38 years, it's really both. But if I can, I'd like to read a sentence that written by Tom McCall when he was talking about the bottle bill. And he says, "When I signed the bottle bill, I said it was one of the most significant legislative acts of any state legislature in the nation to turn us away from use and waste to a positive program of reuse and save." So I think it's fairly clear that the bill was really intended to do both, to reduce litter and to work on conservation issues. Secondly, last week you heard the Oregon wine industry testify that they didn't want to see wine bottles added to the bottle bill because they have a return rate of something like 70%. On the one hand, that's great. That's a very good number for recovery. On the other hand, that really is leading to some of the problems that the curbside collection programs are having currently in the state of Oregon. I just came from the DEQ meeting where they are looking into how to improve the quality of materials that is coming from the curb and going through the material recovery facilities and going on to the markets. One of the problems is that an awful lot of that glass gets misdirected. It gets included in with the paper. And so when people say that we can rather than add these extra containers through a bottle bill program, we can do it by enhancing the curbside program, I would like to caution you that the current curbside program is under a great deal of stress, and I'm not so sure how well they're going to be able to handle additional containers of this nature. And secondly, the difference between 70%, which is where the wine bottles are being recovered now, and something like 80 or 85%, where you would expect wine bottles to be recovered at, were they covered under a deposit legislation, is something like 4 or 4.5 million containers a year, and that's a lot of containers, as far as I'm concerned, that I would like to see recovered. Finally, I would like to say that for House Bill 2184 to work, it really must be a hybrid system. I think we need to keep some form of return to retail, but I also think we need to have redemption centers. And DEQ testified that there is a fairly large amount of unredeemed deposits out there. They said the number was 20%. The industry has debated that number, and that's fine. I could cut that number in half. There's a fair amount of money out there right now for the industry to establish redemption centers. And again, understand that this bill does not call for any changes in addition to containers until 2013. That gives the industry 5 years to move ahead with redemption centers. I go back again, Representative Gillum, to your brother's testimony on 707, where he offered an amendment where the grocers would spend a penny and a half per container, and at 2 billion containers, that's $30 million a year that could be used to operate these redemption centers. And Crink testified before the Bottle Bill Task Force that they thought they could operate their centers for something like $16.4 million a year. So there's certainly money that exists and can exist to operate these redemption centers and to establish these redemption centers. Unlike Mr. Romaine, perhaps I have more faith in the industry than he does. I think they've done, and testimony last week also echoed this, they've done an excellent job in adapting and changing their programs to accept the water bottles, and I certainly think the industry in the next 5 years can do what needs to be done to establish redemption centers so that they can take back these extra containers, because I do think they go hand in hand. I think adding more containers, I would rather not see them all go back to the grocery stores. I know the grocers don't want to see them back to the grocery stores. I'm fine with that, and that's why I think a hybrid system of redemption centers and limited return to retail would be the way to go. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Any questions for this? Panelists. All right. You're excused. Thank you all very much. David Dowry. And I'll try. Did Betsy, is she around? Betsy Earls? No. Okay. If there's anyone else, I don't think so, but if there's anybody else who's here to testify on the bottle bill, now's your chance. Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is David Dowry. I live at 25204 Airport Road, Philomath, Oregon. I'm here as a private citizen, if you will, who's interested in the bottle bill. I've been a firm supporter ever since it was its inception in the 70s. And I'd like to at least start off my testimony. You have in front of you my written testimony that will substantially follow what I say. I've been tracking the experience with the new bottle bill, or the revised bottle bill. I recycle myself, or turn in for deposit, in excess of 10,000 containers a year, so I have some experience with it individually.
Mr. Dowry?
Yes.
Do you consume 10,000 containers a year?
No, I don't.
Okay, so you collect?
I collect.
Okay, very good.
Thank and you. Recycle them.
What state do you live in?
Oregon, of course. Right on.
Go ahead. Sorry for the interruption.
So, the biggest thing that changed with the new bottle bill, or the revised bottle bill, is that you could bring containers from other stores into a store and get them refunded. That makes your trips much more efficient. Before that, you had to sort out the containers and then go to the store that offered the product. Now, you're saving gas, and you're saving time, and you're saving on frustration. Not only that, the actual bottle rooms, if you will, as they're called, are much cleaner now. The waste containers are much emptier because there's less waste, because people, when they get frustrated with returning containers that won't be accepted by the machines, throw them away. So I believe that you will see over time, and you'll probably need a year of experience to really tell, that not only will you have very increased rates of return for water bottles and flavored water bottles, but you'll see that the pop cans or the pop bottles and the beer containers will have increased rates of recycling. In the Corvallis area where I live, I thought there would be more queuing because there's more containers going through the grocery stores. That has not been the case at all. In fact, there's less queuing as before. Perhaps that is because the actual recycling effort is more efficient because you don't have as many cans that being rejected and having to be rerun. Also, as a side benefit for the stores themselves, there tends to be fewer canners, if you will, the expression, hanging out in the return machine area trying to go through the garbage to pick up the containers that the people throw away that actually can be recycled somewhere else. So kudos to the legislature for really doing a good thing, not only for the water bottles, but for the existing pop and beer bottles. Specifically on House Bill 2184, I would recommend that we proceed not too quickly in revising or updating the bottle bill once again. And specifically, there are three areas that I'm concerned about. I would say that the most effective way of increasing the overall recycling rate is to expand the types of beverages that can be returned for deposit. The implementation of water bottles was smooth and seamless. It all it amounted to in terms of the automated sites was to reload their database in the machines, and then the water bottles and flavored water bottles were accepted. Why can't we expand this before 2013 to other types of beverages? I don't see any reason, given how easily it appeared that it was implemented January 1st or in early January. But what we're facing here is really a fundamental problem with the definition of beverages. When we first started with the bottle bill, it covered beer and pop. Since that time, there's been a plethora of beverages that have come onto the market. Clearly, those should have been covered by the bottle bill almost automatically. But the way the bottle bill is structured, it is not inclusive of all beverage containers. And the way it still exists, it specifies one type of container by or one type of beverage by another, so that they've introduced sports drinks. To me, I really don't see any difference between flavored water and Gatorade. And I don't see why that Gatorade, given that it is a container that could go through the existing automated systems, should not be covered. So I think the main requirement in terms of the actual containers is that they can be rotated and go through the current machines, be circular in shape.
I ask you to wind up your testimony, Mr. Dowd.
Okay.
Thank you.
The amount of deposit, I don't think that compared to expanding the refundable container beverage types, I believe that we should wait to see if we need to raise the return deposit to from 5 cents to 10 cents. I think it's too early to tell with a new law. Also, I would suggest that any future that moving in the redemption centers shouldn't preclude having the returns available in the local grocery stores, such as earlier testimony. And if I may, as I wrap up, I do support increasing or expanding the bottle bill. I do know from anecdotal evidence, things that have been shared, that California does require a driver's license, a California driver's license, so that you might check. And that was specifically from people that had tried to return containers that were from Oregon. So.
Thank you. Thank you very much for being here, and it's certainly informative to get the perspective of someone who is so heavily involved as a user of the bottle bill. I suspect that 10,000 may be more than, or well more than the total returned by members of this committee, so I appreciate you, your involvement in sharing your perspective in the last month with these changes, so it's helpful to hear.
I appreciate the time and the opportunity to testify.
Great.
Thank you so much.
Questions from the committee? Representative Boone.
Where do you get all those bottles? Yes.
Well, my dog and I walk on the roads a lot.
Oh, okay.
And that's primarily where it is. And so I have an idea of the sampling along the roads. We walk five miles a day. And he picks them up for me.
Picks them up. I was going to say, I bet you'd have your dog working for you.
I don't want to go in the ditch myself, thanks.
Thank you very much.
That's a good dog.
Yeah. Mr. Tucker, we put your we have your letter. I put it on the record. If that's okay, we'll go ahead and move on. I think we're in great shape. My intention with this bill, members, is to schedule probably two work sessions some number of weeks out to consider amendments to this bill. And I would encourage members to ask LC to start drafting those amendments. If you have them, I can promise that we will consider anything that's prepared. It would be very helpful if you let me or Beth know if you're planning to bring an amendment on this bill to the committee so that we can make sure to schedule the work session in a way that will allow us to consider it. We can have some sort of offline conversation about those amendments as well. But I do expect to move this bill forward, but to do so in a way that takes the best ideas of members of the committee and sees where the votes are before we send it along. So that's the intention, and with that, I will,
Mr. Chair, let's say one
Representative
thing.
Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and this, you may have covered this by your previous comment, but if we do move ahead, I just wanted to go on record as saying I would be interested in discussing or providing amendments that, I'll say it this way, come out of the ideas of the minority report of the bottle bill task force. And I just want to put that on record. But I would obviously, or I intend to inform you if I'm doing an amendment.
Yeah, great. Sounds good. With that, I'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2184. And we have a fairly lengthy agenda. Members, let me ask if anybody knows they need to be somewhere else before 5 o'clock or whether I can count. Representative Benz, 4:30. Okay, we'll go ahead and move into what I expect to be a quick public hearing on House Bill 2625. So I'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2625, and we're expecting Representative Witt to testify on the bill. He went to get him. Okay, and Palmer, Mason, and Ryan Hoof, DQ. We won't go. That's fine. Should we go ahead?
Is he in Ways and Means? I guess. Is he in Ways and Means? Representative Witt. Okay.
Yeah, do you want to go ahead and get started, and we'll allow Representative Witt to put his comments on the record when he arrives?
Sure. Thank you, Chairman Cannon and members of the committee. My name is Palmer Mason. I'm with the Department of Environmental Quality. I assist on legislative issues, and I have here with me Ryan Hoof, who oversees the ballast water program at DEQ, and he will testify to House Bill 2625, as well as give you an update of a report that was sent to the legislature last fall from what is commonly known as the Ballast Water Task Force, and that did include Representative Witt as a member and Senator Berger as the other member of that task force. So we were asked to give you an update about what we do on ballast water and invasive species, and thank you for the time.
Great. Go ahead. Mr. Chair. Actually, before you do, I am going to invite Representative Witt to come on up and help introduce this bill.
Just fine, thanks. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. State Representative Brad Witt from House District 31. I'm very pleased that you're giving House Bill 2625 a hearing. This is a very simple bill. Last session, a bill was passed that banned the dumping of ballast water in the Columbia River, and it received the overwhelming support of both houses. As we all know, it's intended to protect the integrity of the largest river basin here in the Northwest and to prevent potential environmental disasters. I think that we probably have all heard about the dangers that are presented with the introductions possibly of zebra mussels, quagga mussels, and related invasives. This was a tremendous bill to prevent that. Unfortunately, there's a little loophole there that needs to be addressed. And DEQ was assigned authority to monitor on the ballast water dumping, and the bill that passed the legislature never provided them authority to board vessels to monitor that situation. And Mr. Chairman, I suggest to you that this is fundamentally important to banning the dumping of ballast water and the potential introduction of aquatic invasives. So thank you very much for hearing this bill.
Great, and thank you for bringing it to us. Representative Witt, before we move on, does DEQ have any way of performing its monitoring in the absence of this bill? I mean, I'm trying to imagine them sort of swimming next to the boat.
Yes. Well, Mr. Chairman, I suspect that you're going to be hearing from DEQ on this bill, but it is my understanding that up until recently, at least, right before the beginning of the session, I had checked in, and at that point, I don't think there had been any shipper that had challenged their ability to board the vessel. Whether that's still the case, I'm not up to date. But anticipating that at some point that challenge is probably going to arise, DEQ needs this authority.
Great, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Ryan Hoof. I am the Ballast Water Program Manager with DEQ. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today about House Bill 2625 specifically and more generally about efforts to prevent invasive species being introduced from shipping-related pathways. Over 30 non-native invertebrate species are currently in the lower Columbia River. And it's been estimated through a variety of studies that over two-thirds of these can be attributed to shipping activities, primarily ballast water and perhaps biofouling as well. Some of these species have outcompeted and replaced native species as the most abundant taxa in their habitats. The good news is that we have not yet had and do not have any headline-grabbing invasive species that cause devastating economic and or environmental damage, such as the zebra mussel. The bad news is that we continue to play a type of ecological or even economic roulette, given that vast ballast water continue to be dumped into the Columbia River as well as other state waters, just as part of incidental operations of shipping activities. Our native ecosystems are certainly worth protecting intact, and I just want to emphasize that once an aquatic invader does arrive, they are difficult, if not impossible, to remove. That's the importance of prevention. Just for a little perspective about shipping activities in our waters, we receive approximately 150 vessel calls to Oregon waters per year from ports all over the world. Per month, 150 per month. Roughly 45% of these arrivals are discharging ballast water as part of their activities due to changing in load capacity, and it's essential for them to do this as just for safety and stability purposes. A typical bulk carrier servicing our grain export industry on the Lower Columbia River discharges about 10,000 cubic meters of water per arrival. That, just for scale, that's about the equivalent to four Olympic-sized swimming pools. In total, that results in about 8 million cubic meters of water discharged per year. And just to make sure I'm clear, about a single cubic meter of water contains literally thousands of viable organisms. A little background on management of this potential source of biological pollution. The most widely used management practice for minimizing the risk of transferring non-indigenous species from one port to another is considered to be ballast water exchange. This practice replaces high-risk waters taken on from distant port environments with lower-risk waters from the middle of the ocean. It's important to note that although ballast water exchange is most certainly better than doing nothing, it's widely considered to be a stopgap measure and is never considered to be 100% effective. Since 2002, Oregon has had regulations in place that prohibit the discharge of ballast water from outside of our common water zone unless the vessel has conducted proper ballast exchange practices. The DEQ program administers and is active in a variety of different program activities. Four main areas, specifically daily monitoring of arrivals and seeking to make sure that their reporting compliance is accurate. Second, outreach and education with the shipping industry to help make sure that vessel operators coming into our ports are familiar with our requirements. Third area is regional coordination of policy. This is a very active area both regionally, and there's even a wide variety of legislation being proposed at the federal level that could affect our state that we're trying to keep track of. And then fourth is the area of vessel inspections and compliance verification, which is specifically what Representative Witt's bill applies to. And I'll talk about that in a little bit greater detail, but if I have just a couple of minutes to talk about the task force.
Or yeah, and briefly, please.
In recognition of the concerns over aquatic invasive species, the legislator created the task force and then recently renamed it to the Shipping Transport of Aquatic Invasive Species. There is broad representation on this task force. Legislative advisors include Representative Witt and Senator Berger, and this year the task force was chaired by Jane Beccari from the governor's office. But there's also representation from other state agencies, the Coast Guard, neighboring states, academic institutions, NGOs, and the shipping industry. The main goal is to study and make recommendations on changes to the ballast water program. I have provided as a handout the fact sheet describing task force activities. And on the back side of that handout, I've listed the seven primary recommendations that were part of this year's report to the legislature. The first item on that list directly pertains to House Bill 2625, and I'll return to that in just a moment. But just a quick run-through of these other recommendations just to keep you abreast of those. One is to update ballast water noncompliance civil penalties in order to create greater consistency with our neighboring states along the West Coast. Our current penalties are considered to be drastically lower than Washington and California. The third recommendation is to authorize DEQ to develop rules and procedures for implementing emergency ballast management strategies. And the concern here is a hypothetical scenario of a vessel coming in from a very high-risk area that has not conducted proper ballast water exchange, and what protocols we have in place and legal authority we have in place to deal with a situation like that. Fourth is another rulemaking initiative for DEQ to develop rules defining ballast water discharge standards and treatment technology implementation timelines. This largely relates to activities that have already taken place in California and are also underway in Washington, and at a federal level as well. Fifth, to establish some supplemental funding for our program at DEQ. to support sampling activities, travel for regional coordination, database development, and so forth. Sixth is to support continuation of the task force activities. That's being addressed in House Bill 2714, which is coming up for hearing next week. And lastly, to support the involvement of DEQ on the Oregon Invasive Species Council. The agency is currently not a member of that council. So specifically with 2625, Representative Witt's bill, we are in support of this. I want to emphasize that there have not been any problems with DEQ activities to date. The monitoring and inspections that we have done have been strictly based upon record book analysis and auditing, and there haven't been any problems with that. We do anticipate needing to do some more detailed inspections in terms of sampling ballast water in order to actually assess whether or not they are compliant with our management practices, and that's why we feel like this is an important measure to pursue. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Other questions for Representative Boone?
Just a quick one. If a ship's in the Columbia River, does it get boarded by both Washington and Oregon?
We are coordinating to avoid that. There is, certainly is a fair amount of interstate movement between ports on the Columbia, and we keep close contact. Washington has two ballast water inspectors who I speak with regularly to make sure that we're not doubling up and inspecting the same vessels.
Follow-up question. So if Washington boards and levies their fine and it's more than Oregon, how does that work out? Depends on who you get.
Well, fortunately, we haven't had a situation that we have to deal with that yet. Okay. So there hasn't been a situation where we've had fines levied on a vessel twice.
May I, Chair Cannon, speak to that? Representative Boone, one of the bills that DEQ pre-filed this year is Senate Bill 105. That bill does try to level the penalties with regard to ballast water so that they're the same as Washington. So that is an active piece of legislation this year. Yeah.
Representative Bernhardt.
Thank you. I have a couple of technical questions. The current statute requires ships to exchange their ballast at sea. And I presume that flushing the fresh water that may be in the ballast and exchanging it for seawater is adequate to kill these invasive species that you're concerned about. Is that an accurate assumption on my part?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Barnhart, that is a correct assumption. The goal with ballast water exchange is twofold, to reduce the number of organisms, because typically the concentration of organisms in coastal and port environments is much higher than the middle of the ocean. And secondarily, to provide a physiological stress to the organisms that remain in the tank. The concern with ballast water exchange and my comment about it not being 100% effective relates to particularly in the cases where ballast is taken on in a marine port, and they are then discharging in another marine port. There's less of a degree of change in the salinity factor to cause that physiological stress. The other factor of concern is that the flushing of these tanks, depending on the configuration of the actual tank, is never complete. Just due to fluid dynamics, there's often lots of large pockets that remain that don't get flushed.
And the second question, if I may.
Go ahead, Representative Berger.
What's the effect on, the Willamette River, Columbia River, of flushing of large amounts of seawater into the river from ships that are rebalancing their water ballast?
Representative Barnhart, I think that's a great question. It's something that we have not looked into in great detail in terms of the impact of particular changes in chemical base, the salinity influx, and things of that nature. That hasn't been considered.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You, Representative Gittin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Quickly, I noticed we've got no fiscal, right? But is that covered by your number five on your recommendations? In other words, if you get the money that you mentioned in number five, you would cover the cost of this? Well, that not related.
I'll provide a follow-up, and if you have anything to add, please correct me. But currently, we are doing some inspections, and this bill will certainly just add or bolster our legal authority to do so. The current quantity of inspections that are taking place is fairly small. Less than 5% of vessels are being inspected. The supplemental funding that was requested is for some other additional types of analyses and additional equipment that we do not have right now that we would like, but is not in any way associated with this bill.
Right.
May I, Mr. Chairman, respond
Go ahead,
to that? Representative Gilliam, just to add on to that, DEQ did not request in the governor's budget any of this funding that was in the task force, so I just wanted to make that clear. And then on the bill itself, Representative Witt's bill, it's just simply to give us that physical access and clear authority to have that physical access to do the things that Ryan is talking about.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Representative Witt, for bringing the bill.
And, thank you very much.
Look forward to getting it out of this committee in just a few minutes.
Thank you.
A few minutes, but let's hear first from Tom Wolf, Trout Unlimited.
Chair Cannon, committee members, I'll keep this very brief. First of all, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the chair of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited. I represent the 3,000 members of Trout Unlimited here in the state of Oregon, and of which we are part of 160,000 member organization throughout the United States. We're the largest cold water conservation group in the United States, and dealing with aquatic invasive species is a very important agenda for us, and I am pleased to say that we greatly support this bill. It is a great bill. It closes any loopholes that might possibly exist because, as we can see from disasters in other states where zebra mussels, quagga mussels, green crabs, and others have gotten into systems, they devastate the ecology of the stream or river or lakes that they're in. They cause tremendous economic impact. Cities, counties, states spend millions of dollars trying to clean up these invasive species. So we need to have DEQ have this authority to inspect certain ships, and so I say pass this bill and get it done with. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Question? Thanks for being here.
All right.
With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2625 and open a work session on House Bill 2625. And I would accept an amendment, a motion on this bill.
So do you want a motion to move it to the floor with a do-pass recommendation?
And that it be placed on the consent calendar. We can discuss it and see whether that's appropriate. But I think it will.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2625 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that it be placed on the consent calendar.
Is there any Representative Smith moves House Bill 2625 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation and that the measure be placed on the consent calendar? Is there discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The kind of power that we're talking about conferring is very, very normal for any kind of inspection a system where you're trying to enforce health regulations or environmental regulations. It's clear to me that it must have been an oversight to have left it out in the first place. This seems pretty obvious.
Yeah, I think that's the case. Any other discussion? Thank you for that comment. I personally really like this bill. When I read it initially, I thought of this as the pirate bill with DEQ boarding these ships at sea. And nice. I thought, does DEQ have a flotilla, have a fleet under its command? And then I learned a little more about it. But I still can't get that pirate image out of my head. Any further discussion?
Sure.
Representative Jensen.
Mr. Chair, in light of the image that's running around in your head, I'm wondering if I shouldn't object to it being in the just because somewhere between now and the time it comes to the floor, I might figure out what was producing all of those images.
I assure you, only my own miscomprehension of the bill, Representative Jensen.
I mean, to carry it up to wear an eye patch.
The clerk will please call the roll.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Bent.
Aye.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam.
Aye. That was too obvious, man. It was too obvious.
The motion carries.
And
I'll close the work session on House Bill 2625, and we're going to open a work session for the purpose of introduction of committee measures. Members, you have a packet of measures, LC drafts. Keep in mind our usual disclaimer on the introduction of committee bills. This is does not represent voting yes on a motion to introduce committee measures. Does not reflect your support. It certainly doesn't reflect my support for any particular measure under consideration. Could I have a motion related to the introduction of the committee bills?
Mr. Chair, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 2113, dated February 23rd, 2009. Would you like me to do all of them?
Yeah, let's go. We'll do them in a single motion.
Okay. LC 2948, dated February 3rd, 2009. LC 2949, dated February 25th, 2009. LC 2978, dated February 6th, 2009. LC 3625, dated February 9th, 2009.
Representative Smith moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 2113, LC 2948, LC 2949, LC 2978, and LC 3625. Is there any discussion? Is there objection? Seeing none, the measures are introduced as committee bills. I will close the work session for introduction to committee measures and open a work session on House Bill 2080. Members, this is the bill related to gray water, water reuse. It was a priority of the Interim Committee on Energy and Environment. We took testimony over several interim committee meetings and then in public hearing in January in front of this committee. The bill has been, there's an amendment before us. I'm going to ask our committee administrator, Beth Petrino, to talk a little bit about the amendment and how we got to this point.
Mr. Chair, members, you should have in front of you a hand-engrossed version of the bill up in the right-hand corner. It says hand-engrossed. And what I thought I would do is just very quickly walk through this and point out to you what the amendment would do to the bill. The first change is on page 2, and it is a change to the definition of gray water. It clarifies that this definition includes bathroom sink wastewater and laundry wastewater that is uncontaminated by soiled diapers, and that is the primary change to the definition. If you move to page 3 of the hand-engrossed version, the new language that replaces what the bill had initially proposed specifies that these systems may not be constructed, installed, or operated without first obtaining a permit from the Department of Environmental Quality. If properly permitted, those systems are then exempt from the subsurface disposal system permitting requirements. It also directs the Environmental Quality Commission to, in addition to considering recommendations of an advisory committee, to minimize the burden of any permitting requirements on property owners. So the next change is on page 4 and directs that the EQC adopt rules which prescribes requirements that allow for these separate systems for disposal or reuse of gray water, and also further requires that these requirements ensure the protection of public health, safety, and welfare, public water supplies, and waters of the state. The remainder of the bill is deleted, and that was the result of just some reconciliation of the new language, and it was no longer necessary to make the proposed changes in that section of statute. In terms of the process, there was a work group that met once. We talked about the changes, went back and got language together. They reviewed the proposed amendment over email, and as far as I know, everybody is currently okay with the amendment.
We also, members, have a fiscal statement that we're required to have before moving this bill along. You might take a look at that. And I'm going to ask Christine, would you come forward and be available to answer any questions, and Director Springer as well. I have a feeling... Peterson, I'm sorry. And I have a feeling there may be... some questions on the bill. Members? Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm curious, and maybe I'm just not quite understanding the amendment well enough, and let me preface this by saying that I think fundamentally we're up against the challenge of the fact that we want to figure out a way for folks to be able to reuse gray water for other purposes, while at the same time we have an inability to control exactly what goes into that gray water. And in reading the First Amendment on page 2, the new lines 3, 4, and 5 in the hand engrossed, It says water and laundry waste uncontaminated by soiled diapers, which was a concern I recall we voiced here on the committee. And then on the next page, it describes a process for getting a permit for that system. So I guess I have a couple of questions. Does the permit relate to the content of the gray water or simply to the structure of the system?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bailey, for the record, my name is Dick Peterson. I'm the director of the Department of Environmental Quality, and just with me today is Christine Svetkovich. She's the legislative coordinator for the Water Quality Program for detailed questions. Right now, the permit, as it's being envisioned, would be designed certainly to protect public health and the environment. So using rules developed by EQC, we would put the framework around so that water that left the house that was used for irrigation purposes met conditions that were defined in rule. We could, and this would be the topic of rulemaking, whether or not we would envision in that that's the makeup of gray water would also be captured in that. We haven't decided that, but that's something that we could do.
And Christine, maybe you can address in even more detail the way the rulemaking process, the kinds of considerations that you might undertake when you begin rulemaking, which is, in essence, what this bill asks you to do.
Sure. Chair Cannon, members of the committee, my name is Christine Svetkovich, again, with the Department of Environmental Quality. And there, if this bill passes and we would first pull together an advisory committee made up of numerous technical people as well as citizens who are interested in this topic to provide us guidance. And there are a number of considerations that we will have to give to whatever the framework of the permits would be. And those include what the makeup of the gray water as well as the what types of systems would be allowed at what amounts and so on. So they will take into consideration a number of issues.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess perhaps some of my confusion arises from the change that specifically references soiled diapers. Mm-hmm. So it makes me wonder if that's the only thing that we're going to be looking at, whereas the change and the last change for public health and safety and welfare seems to imply much broader rules around safety of that stream. So I'm curious if you could address why in particular soiled diapers were called out.
Maybe I can take a shot at it. Chair Cannon, Representative Bailey, I think one of the biggest concerns about gray water is fecal contamination and the spread of disease. So I think thinking about what's in gray water, really what could be a source of fecal contamination is soiled diapers, if they're in washing machines or however. So that's, as I understand, where the committee was concerned to make sure that there was that level of protection. But yes, you're right. The broader initiative to protect, or the direction here to protect public health and environment would be to ensure that whatever goes out does not compromise that end of it in terms of people that might be exposed. But for this kind of waste, it would be primarily a bacteria that would be of concern.
And that, go ahead, Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to state for the record that my concerns as well, and as my understanding from your testimony that these will be addressed, is that my concerns would also extend to other toxics that people would pour down their sink, solvents, and even extending to consumer products that have effects on the human endocrine system and that could end up in gray water streams and on foods that people consume mm-hmm. out of their gardens. So my concerns extend to those as well. I guess, and then final follow-up question, Mr. Chair. If the permits are to also include the content of the gray water stream, once the permit is issued, how is it enforced, and how do we know that people then aren't washing diapers in their sinks?
Chair Cannon, Representative Bailey, as with any DEQ program where we have rules, we have an enforcement component. So they would link back to an enforcement process by which we would look to that, whether it be detail in the permit that would require either some monitoring, or it would certainly allow us to inspect a discharge if we chose to do so, to collect our own samples. And if there's violations, then it would trigger an enforcement action, whatever that may be.
I'm going to comment briefly on the definitional change that the amendment proposes to make on page 2 of the bill. I think there was a real question for the work group on this, you know, how, and for us now, how detailed to get with the definition. We tried to strike a compromise. It's more restrictive than the initial definition of gray water that was that's in the original bill, but it still leaves room for this advisory committee and ultimately your rulemaking process to determine a sort of precise definition about what would be permissible and what would not under a gray water system. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I suppose as a somewhat of a question or a rebuttal of the wisdom that you put into this here, I'm wondering about being that loose in the statute, not questioning the department's or the agency's ability to write rules. I mean, that's what they get paid to do. So they do that often and sometimes well, and sometimes sometimes something else, which we probably better be careful where I go with that, otherwise we might get the wrong idea. So I'm wondering why that might not say something like soil diapers or any material that might contain specifically fecal material, since that apparently is what the area of concern has been. So that's just my thought.
Do you have a response to that? And then
Chair Cannon, I just off the top of my head, I don't see why that would create any issues for us in this bill.
Okay. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to follow up on Representative Bailey's concerns and add an additional point that may or may not be relevant. When in a statute, when you name a specific item like this, you have to be careful, because it might be construed that you're limiting the definition simply by the fact that you've excluded talking about other things, and that would concern me a lot. I think Representative Bailey had a much more extensive list, which I will not try to repeat, but all of the items on his list concern me as well. In addition to fecal material, the other items that he referred to, I think, are also important. I don't know whether the committee wants to consider a more general definition that would conform more closely to the more general definition on page 4, having to do with the protection of the public safety and welfare and so forth, or whether you may want to actually list some of these other areas of concern and then expect that the agency is going to do some rulemaking in that area. I think you may exclude them from doing rulemaking on the areas that Representative Bailey referred to if you have one specific exception to laundry waste. That concerns me a lot, given what I know about the way agencies tend to write rules around statutes. You know, months after the fact, when the conversation that took place in the committee is long forgotten.
Let's get your response to that specific question of whether singling out a particular contaminant means that your rulemaking process might have difficulty creating a more specific set of conditions. I mean, that I think was the kind of gist of your question.
Representative Cannon, Representative Barnhart, my take on this, especially if I read Section 4, that's pretty all-encompassing to protect public health and the environment from whatever permit and rule we might write. So even if I were to look at this in absence of the identification of soil diapers, whatever we allow in this bill through a permit to put on gray water, we would be ensuring that we're not putting fecal material out there through the permit that's written, and that's how the rules would be developed, along with other constituents that might be of concern for exposure on food or to people from a gray water use.
Representative Bentz.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This conversation brings me back to the meeting we held in the summer and I attended regarding the entire concept and all of the work that your department is going to have to do to allow certain households to use this gray water. We've developed these systems to control the flow of this and then take care of it in a massive way as opposed to an individual way. I'm just curious, as you look at this from the director's chair, whether the cost of everything you're going to have to do from the writing of the rules down to the enforcement activity and checking to make sure someone hasn't sold the house that used to be permitted, and now they do have 12 kids and there's the small chance of fecal matter. I mean, how are you going to, in your opinion, is this thing going to work for us in a way that actually makes some sort of economic sense?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, first stepping back, if I look at the opportunity to use gray water in a fashion other than just going into a wastewater treatment system where the cost of treatment, as you add it all up from a broad perspective, adds cost and burden from that perspective. We do allow reuse of water in different contexts, whether it's at rules we just passed at a wastewater treatment facility for irrigation or in a commercial business. Along that, this is the next step, I think, that gives people the opportunity to look at the use of water, to conserve water in ways that we may need to down the road. Now, stepping back and looking at the cost of this, I think the way this has been structured and the way we've looked at it, we would do it in a stepwise fashion, and we would write rules as directed here that would be minimal in terms of a permit burden on homeowners that would want to do that, but are protective. And we would develop the program in a stepwise way, so as people come in, if there's a lot of people that come into this program and there's a lot of financial burden, we could come back to a future legislature to look at the cost of implementing what I think would be a good program and a reuse of water that keeps it out of out of the pipe and onto the ground in that opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mm-hmm. It seems to me that to keep this as just as simple as Representative Barnhart and others have suggested, just as simple as you possibly could, mm-hmm. only one kind of really clean water can be used in these and avoid all of those other possibilities, because the enforcement, the danger that we're subjecting everybody else to because of this, the creation of these systems, is really considerable, and as you know. And I'm just wondering, some focusing on something that one of those streams of waste that is usually clean, and then the rest of them just no. Mm-hmm. That seems to me to be the highest level of protection. But you'll be writing the rules if this passes. So it just seems to me that we're opening a very, very big opportunity for a lot of people to get hurt unless this is appropriately managed.
Chair Cannon, Representative Bentz, I think your point is good, and I think the instructions here and our obligations ensure the protection of public health and the environment. And if we're not able to do that in rulemaking with this, then the rule probably wouldn't go forward.
Representative Bentz, do you have a question?
I did, and I have a couple of things. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is this just for residential use? Because I think I saw county, municipal.
Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, this is just for residential use.
And then follow up, because I wanted to double up on what I think Rep. Barnhart mentioned. If you define the gray water as shower and bath and wastewater, bathroom sink water, kitchen sink wastewater, the only place you're mentioning soiled diapers is in the wash water. But anybody who's had a baby knows you bathe them in the sink and, you know, and in the bathtub, and sometimes they do things during the bath.
There.
So I'm thinking, I bet Ben knows all about that, yeah. So anyway, that was kind of my concern, too. So there's no way to, you can't say to the baby, don't do that, because they will.
You can't.
Right.
And I don't know how you deal with it, because it's not always dealable.
So, Chair Cannon, Representative Boone, if I might, certainly there could be some level of treatment required as this stuff goes out, whether it's simple disinfection or something. I don't know. That's the kind of thing that we would look at in rulemaking.
And this, Representative Smith, do you have a question?
Yes.
Okay. Hang on to it for just a sec. I mean, this level of...
It includes a question.
This level of detail, this level of complexity reflects, I think, the kind of discussion that would take place during the rulemaking process. It's the place that we began to go as a work group that some members of the work group might have liked us to get to. Others said, well, let's
bring together the appropriate folks in advisory committee, really flesh this out. Will a treatment system be required? And probably so under certain types. If you're trying to use it for certain types of purposes, it might have to be treated. That's the kind of detail that I think we anticipated the advisory committee and the rulemaking would deal with. I think the challenge is clearly to provide enough security to, you know, public health that we can feel really confident moving this bill forward, knowing that a lot of the details will remain to be fleshed out. Representative Smith.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. You had a few thoughts. Some of them reflect those that have been mentioned. I will try not to redundant. I share the interest in wondering if a more general, maybe made more specific with some bullets, but a more clear definition of gray water might be smart. That's first thought. Second thought, I think we could probably, and by we I mean our polity, could probably get away with for a couple of reasons. One, because generally, I mean, as a law clerk, or as my judge would say, a baby judge, we just have to play this game. And this sentence is a little weird for me. In part, Representative Boone's comment where she says that uncontaminated by soil diapers only modifies laundry wastes. Actually, I could imagine a reader who might think that modified every clause. And I sit here right now uncertain as to whether it's supposed to modify every clause or merely the last clause. And I won't repeat Representative Barnhart's concerns, but share them, that when one specific is named, it doesn't necessarily exclude others, but it makes one wonder. So I do think that. And what else did I want to say? Oh, and in addition to poopy diapers, which I am concerned about, the silver polish, paint thinner. But my last thought, and one of the reasons thought that we might be able to get away with it, is that. I would wonder if our standards for what we flush down our sinks and then might be allowed to put in our lawns would be any more lax than whatever standards might exist for what we're allowed to put on our lawns right now that come out of a bottle rather than out of our sinks. And I don't know the answer to that, but at least it potentially gives me some comfort, because I see the people on my street putting any number of things on there that I think is worse than poopy diapers, but, you know, can't be sure.
Representative Gideon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Just some phraseology.
The question is, how do you feel about that? The phraseology I didn't expect in this committee, but, you know, I can live with it. Now, I wasn't on the interim committee, I wasn't on the work group, and I can't find my notes from when we first heard this bill in January. So other than that, I'm
But that's not going to stop you.
But that's... I'm
prepared
I know
to move
very
on.
Little. To say this. Oh, I can get your notes? And by the way, thank you for committee bills that didn't actually involve DEQ today. I appreciate that. So you're here again. And here's what I want to know, or this is what I suspect, is we don't know, we don't have a baseline for treating gray water in high-density areas with lots and lots of residents and neighbors. And I'm very concerned, not with your ability to rulemake or with the potential for saving water, but when we move this kind of legislation forward that'll affect this many kind of neighbors and this many kind of folk, I'm concerned that we won't be able to handle it along the lines that have already been mentioned. And secondly, it'll encourage folks, just by virtue of people who do legally seek a permit, just to go ahead with some gray water experimentation because it's prevalent now as a way to recycle water. So I think the scale of this thing scares me, and I would love to have heard maybe some discussion about tests in certain communities first before we move ahead statewide. Yeah, I don't know if there's a question there, but you're welcome to comment on it.
Chair Cannon, Representative Gilliam, I think those are very good points. What was going through my mind when you were speaking about that, I think there are some people that are very interested in making this work. Just from a residential, I don't think it's, you know, right now a huge number of people. That's why I'm sort of comforted by taking time in terms of how much the program might cost. But the people that want to do it with the right criteria, know they're doing it right, and demonstrate that, in fact, when they're doing it, they're not harming their neighbors or other people? I think that's a very good question, and it's certainly one that we'll have to debate in a rulemaking process.
Committee, I think the challenge we face with this bill is the degree to which we try to deal in a careful and nuanced way with all the possibilities related to gray water and gray water systems. I mean, we could spend the time as a committee to try to get this definition to a place where it satisfied, you know, every one of our sort of hypothetical, nightmarish situations where it was sensitive to the different kinds of treatment options that might exist for different kinds of systems, where it was sensitive to the different types of soils and different regions of the state, the kinds of questions that I think the advisory group and the rulemaking process would take up. And I certainly appreciate the committee's concern for making sure that whatever we pass here does protect public health and welfare. My sense from the discussion today is that we do need a little more time and perhaps a little more work to feel comfortable with moving this bill forward. I will, however, caution us that it could very easily become a morass because those questions require a lot of deliberation and potentially more than this legislature in this session will have the capacity for. When we brought the work group together, it included, you know, representatives of Plumbing Board, the Special Districts, City of Portland, EWEB, League of Cities, DEQ, Building Codes Division, Confluence Consulting, Willamette River Keepers. I mean, these stakeholders who considered all of these, and I think each one of them with a real considerable interest in ensuring that whatever we do doesn't jeopardize the safety and health of our communities. And they felt comfortable with the language that you see before us. So I certainly respect the fact that we may need to get a few more of our questions answered before we move on, but also want to suggest that we may not be successful at really trying to get a lot more detail in this bill. Representative Smith.
Yeah, two options that I can, thank you, Mr. Chair. Two options that I can imagine. One is I personally can't speak for others. I personally would be comfortable moving it as it is and talking to the Senate, getting it through the process. That I can speak only for myself. A second option, related to what Representative Barnhart would say, would be to simplify the sentence, maybe just say gray water means uncontaminated, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Define uncontaminated. Under the definition of uncontaminated, to say it will include, okay, or you know, it excludes such things as soiled by fecal matter and poopy diapers, the solvents, silver polish, etc., you know, and at the top and at the bottom, not limited to, you know, the Department of Environmental Quality will, you know, define further, right? So I could imagine an edit that would do both, that would give us some balance of both, would give us some, the specifics our addled brains can come, at least mine can think of right now, not limited to, but not put that in the header sentence in case that confuses people later. I would be comfortable, Mr. Chair, with either with either course, and I can only speak for myself.
Great. Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry, I'm looking at Beth. I do, knowing that it's a individual homeowner's property, it's not for distribution anywhere off their property, I'm more comfortable with that now, and to move it on, I could support moving it on. And after what you said, Mr. Chair, about the work of the work group, I can't imagine anybody who wants this would be so irresponsible as to put, you know, nasty stuff on their vegetables. They're probably growing an organic garden anyway, and they would be very careful about what they did use. They'd probably use good kind of soap, like Ivory soap or whatever is the best kind to put on your aphids anyway. You know what I'm saying? So I don't think I've got any more questions right now.
Okay.
I'm good to go if you want to do it.
Representative Bailey.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a general contextual comment and then two quick points. I think fundamentally this bill is about to what degree are we comfortable with some, I think, inherent risks and trade-offs? And to what degree are we comfortable with delegating the resolution of those risks? Two things that would help me get a little bit closer to being comfortable. One is to resolve the, in my opinion, the tension in the language between the specific definition with the soiled diapers and the more general language in Section 4. And if we could get to a resolution on that, which does not seem difficult to me, that would make me more comfortable. Second thing, to return to Representative Bentz, who is now departed, brought up a point that's been sticking in my mind, and I wish he was here to reiterate it better than I can. But his discussion of inclusive versus exclusive definitions, and is there a way that we can define what appropriate gray water is rather than what it is not? And instead of really specifically listing all the different things that we don't want in it, is there a way that we could create one definition of it to say it is this, and anything that's not this is not appropriate gray water? So I want that. That's a, both a question and a suggestion.
Great. Any other comments?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barker.
We're moving, Mr. Chair, from a definition having to do with the site that the water comes from to something about what it contains. With the exception in the amendment of the one item that we've already been referring to, this definition only talks about the site the water comes from. I would be a lot more comfortable with a definition of the kind that Representative Bailey is describing than the one that we have now. And maybe let me make one more comment. This committee has spent a lot of time on this bill. If we can't come up with a definition that we're satisfied with, I doubt very much the Senate can. I would rather work the bill here than send it there in hopes that they can fix it.
Representative Barnhart, despite my high regard for our Senate colleagues, particularly knowing their schedule and their work load, I think that is entirely right.
And Mr. Chair, it wasn't a comment about the quality of the senators. It was a comment about the work time.
Yeah. I think it's right on. Any final comments from you? I think we're gonna hold this off for another day. But if you want to,
just real quickly, Mr. Chair, I think the addition of the uncontaminated by soil diapers is confounding the definition here, because I'm not suggesting we do this just to give you an idea of what we might talk about. Before that is a very typical definition of gray water. It's showers, bathwater, bathroom sink. And then if you go to Section 4, it's what you're expected to not. The result of putting out there is doesn't cause compromised public health. So I think there's some opportunities there to clarify.
Yeah, indeed. I am gonna ask that we'll come back to this on another day. I think there's a real opportunity for us to move this forward in a way that feels very good to all members of the committee. I mean, this is a great opportunity to allow water users to conserve, to reuse, to put water to good use, and free them from some of the regulation that might prohibit that now. And I think it's an exciting idea, one that shows a lot of merit. Clearly, we want to get a few more questions answered, at least for several members of the committee, and then move forward with it in that way. Representative Gilliam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What you can do, yes or no on this.
Okay.
Was there a discussion either at your department level or in the work group of tests or tests that have been done in Oregon for residential gray water?
Christine.
Either doing it in a test mode or that you've got data from other communities to try it?
Chair Cannon, Representative Gilliam, yes. We've looked at actually a number of tests around the country related to gray water. In Oregon, the data that we have is from the 1970s, so it's fairly old, but we do have the data that we have from different parts of the country is much more recent.
All right. And Are you looking for comments on the quality of the senators at this point?
No, not from you.
I would put my foot in it. You don't need to.
I'll close the work session on House Bill 2080 and open a work session on House Bill 2232. And Beth, do you want to bring us up to speed on this bill, please? Mm-hmm.
Mr. Chair, members, in front of you, you should have a 2232-5 amendment. And I'll just briefly describe what this amendment does. First of all, it does replace the bill entirely, just because it got a little difficult to make the changes and not get into a whole lot of fixes. The first thing that the amendment does is clarifies that the bill applies to holes drilled to assess water quality that are open less than 72 hours. There was a question about which holes, water quality holes, this would apply to. It also establishes the Water Resources Department's geotechnical fund, which is where these fees would be placed. The original bill would have put the fees into the Star Card fund, so the amendment changes that and creates a new fund. And it further directs that the fee revenue be appropriated to the department for duties, functions, and powers related to geotechnical holes. Finally, it would add an emergency clause to the bill. There is a fiscal statement also in your packet, and the bill does have a subsequent referral to Ways and Means.
Brenda, Kevin, do you want to be available for any questions on this?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair. Yeah. I'm Brenda Bateman with Water Resources Department, and with me this afternoon is Tom Paul, our Deputy Director.
Members, I don't know if you've had a chance. This was, I believe, emailed out, if you've had a chance to look at it. Representative Jensen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a couple of questions. On the first page of the bill, line 14, I think it is, yeah, B, 2B, section 2B, if I get that correct, line 14. Within 50 feet of a water supply or a monitoring well. The language is unclear to me exactly what you mean here. I'm wondering if you, I mean, water supply could be anything. Okay. Or if you mean the a well water supply, in which case I think it could be written 50 feet of a water supply or monitoring well.
Chair Cannon, Representative Jensen, a water supply well can be used for domestic drinking or irrigation, industrial. It's a well drilled for the purpose of finding water and then using that water. So it is pretty broad.
Representative Jensen.
But to me, the language doesn't say water supply well.
Yes. Okay.
Same from
here. Well,
go ahead. You know.
Mr. Chair, Representative, this language actually comes from rules that are already existing with the department, and
Hang on, Representative Jensen.
Is actually meant to read water supply well or monitoring well, and we could clarify that.
Representative Jensen.
Well, I wasn't. If the rule reads like this, and I were reading the rule, I would question the rule too. So I don't think that's a good. If you want to say water supply well, then put water supply well needs to be in there. Otherwise, I think there's ambiguity as to exactly what it is.
Right, I agree.
Chair Cannon, Representative Jensen, the intent is water supply well.
Okay. I thought that, but I wanted to make the point because. Okay. Second, questions. Is there language in the bill that excludes push probes?
Chair Cannon, Representative Jensen, nothing in the bill talks about how the geotech hole is developed, so there would not be anything that would exclude any certain type of construction method.
Should there not be maybe something in there excluding push probes?
Chair Cannon, Representative Jensen, the intent here is to address geotechnical holes that are put in. The limit would be 18 feet or greater than 18 feet, and most of the push probes would be shallower unless those developments were placed in an area of contamination or within the set distances from a water well or monitoring well.
I'm not going to ride that horse any further than okay. this. I'm just, you know, raising the issue here as we're talking about it. I'm inclined to think there maybe should be some language there, but I'll, after having planted the seed, if the department doesn't think so, I'm not going to, at this point, fall on my sword.
And let me suggest, Representative Jensen, this bill has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means and to your subcommittee in Ways and Means, and this drafting issue related to water supply well may be one that we can take care of with an amendment in the Natural Resources Subcommittee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate that you serve on that committee so that, you know, I am reluctant in Ways and Means to do policy revisions.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm going to do a policy revision in Ways and Means, I want to cross that bridge here.
I appreciate that.
So that when we do it, you know, the committee at least can go to bat for me and say that we knew what he was doing.
Thank you, Representative Jensen. Appreciate
thank you. Then the last thing, the language at the end, seems to be somewhat overly broad to me, where you eliminate the limiting 50%, and put it in just a rather broad sort of department duties, function, powers related to geotechnical holes. And I put this question out: is this what you really, you know, or would do you feel that it would be better to limit it more like it was in the original language?
Chair Cannon, for the record, I apologize here. For the record, Tom Paul, Deputy Director, Oregon Water Resources Department. Representative Jensen, we have worked closely with Legislative Fiscal to try to get some wording that will allow us to accomplish the tasks that we see ahead of us for receiving the well or the geotech log reports, as well as receiving the money and reviewing for completeness and doing an occasional inspection. We have tried to look to see whether the 50% split would work, and we didn't feel that it would just because of the varying nature of the workload associated with this.
Okay. Well, if necessary, we probably can probe that at another time, Mr. Chair, and I would submit to moving the bill at your discretion.
Thank you. Any other questions or comments?
Mr. Chair?
Representative.
I have a question either to you or to any of the many, several people on the committee more senior to me. And that is, if we see what we would deem a Scrivener's error, if we have a way to make a bill that, you know, just that I would say off the record, with the which is clearly on the record, just bad drafting, right? What is our leeway to correct that bad drafting, or must we wait a month to have the drafting corrected?
How quickly do you want Ramona to come on down to this here?
She's on her way down right now. Okay. All right. All right.
It has come up before, and I've sat on a committee where we.
There's just the one little word.
Basically,
there.
Did it right, but.
One letter or one word.
Yeah.
Yeah. Representative.
Just a word from the old broad on the team. I hope you have all your bill backs back.
I have been impressed by a lot of it's wonderful drafting that almost always happens, which is why in the very rare case when we get a small error, would you see me easy?
Pedal faster, pedal.
I'd accept a motion on the -5 amendments.
So
Representative Jensen moves we adopt the -5 amendments dated 2/18/09 to House Bill 2232. Is there any discussion? We've had some discussion. Any additional discussion? Is there Representative Gilliard.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just by a show of hands, is there anyone in the room that would like to hear my anti-fee speech? Fine.
I have the DVD.
I gather there will be an objection, at least to the underlying bill, but on the amendments, the Dash 5 amendments, let's go ahead and have the clerk read the roll.
Representative Bailey?
Aye.
Representative
Barnhart?
Aye.
Representative
Boone?
Aye.
Representative
Jensen?
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam?
No.
Chair Cannon?
Aye. The Dash 5 amendments are adopted, and a motion on the bill.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Jensen.
I would move House Bill 2232 as amended to the floor with the due pass, or to the House, or to the Joint Ways and Means, to the Joint Ways and Means Committee. I'll get it right here.
Yeah, and I think that, Representative Jensen moves House Bill 2232 as amended to the floor with that referral to the Ways and Means Committee by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Representative Barnhart.
Mr. Chair, it's not clear to me how we resolved the issue over the word. How did we resolve that?
I suggested that we would take this discussion to Ways and Means, to Representative Jensen's subcommittee, and ask for an amendment at that point.
And that was acceptable to Representative
Jensen? That was acceptable to Representative Jensen. I serve on that subcommittee as well, and can vouch for the fact that the policy conversation took place here.
It beats fix it in the Senate.
Beats. Any further discussion? Will the clerk please call the roll?
Representative Bailey.
Aye.
Representative Barnhart.
Aye.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative Jensen.
Aye.
Vice Chair Smith.
Aye.
Vice Chair Gilliam.
No.
Chair Cannon.
Aye, and the motion is adopted. And members, I think we're 5 minutes to 5. We are out of here. On Tuesday, we're working to put together an informational session on federal stimulus dollars that may be related to water projects in Oregon. So we'll get an update on what we may see coming to the state via the federal stimulus. So it should be an exciting conversation, and I think there's still many unknowns. So we'll be potentially gathering some folks who haven't yet talked to each other about what they're eyeing in that big bill from Congress. With that, I'll close the House Environment and Water Committee.
In federal, that's our big chance.